Welcome to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. Today's program is a lecture given by geologist David R. Montgomery in the Great Hall of Memorial Union earlier this fall as part of the two-day PASIC Colloquium on Sustainable Agriculture at ISU. Here is ISU Professor Matt Liebman introducing the speaker.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 2013 PESIC Colloquium on Sustainable Agriculture. My name is Matt Liebman. It's my distinct pleasure and privilege tonight to welcome our speaker, Professor David Montgomery. Dr. Montgomery leads the Geomorphology Research Group in the Department of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. His work focuses on the natural and social forces that have shaped the surface of the Earth and on environmental history. He's the author of three books reflecting these interests to date: King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon, which was published in 2003, Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, published in 2007, and The Rocks Don't Lie, A Geologist Investigates Noah's Flood, which was published last year. Dr. Montgomery's excellence and originality in scholarship and communications were widely recognized in 2008 when he became a recipient of the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Award. I'm extremely pleased that he can be with us tonight to discuss soil erosion, a topic of great importance here in Iowa and globally. The subject of Dr. Montgomery's presentation is especially well-suited to the PESIC Colloquium, which honors the work, commitment, and contributions of John PESIC, Iowa State University Emeritus Professor of Agronomy and a soil scientist of international renown. Dr. PESIC's work in soil fertility and other areas led scientists to a better understanding of the effects of agricultural management practices, not just on crop production, but also on the environment. Dr. PESIC also addressed in considerable depth and breadth the challenges and diverse paths to agricultural sustainability. Please join me in welcoming him to Iowa State University.
Well, thank you all for coming tonight. It's a real honor to give this PESIC lecture this year, in part because I'm not a soil scientist. I'm a geologist by training. And so the first thing that I really want to do is not apologize for the title of my book, Dirt. I'm fully aware that you are never, ever supposed to call soil dirt. I was taught this by the guy who taught me soil science. It was a sin to basically say that in that class. And, my two defenses about why I would title a book about the importance for soil for civilization, dirt, is one, once soil is eroded off of a farm field and it goes somewhere where it was not created, it has become dirt. Once it's eroded, it has been transformed. That's my intellectual defense. My other defense is that my publisher really didn't like the idea of writing a book called Soil, the Stuff We All Really Need. So with that non-apology to start, let me give you the real reason that a geologist like myself, trained in hard rock geology, would write a book about why soils are essentially what I like to consider our most fundamental yet underappreciated resource. And that is, I really have come to see, as a geomorphologist, the kind of geologist who studies the evolution of topography, what shapes the surface of the earth that we know and walk around on, I've really come to see over several decades of research on that soil is truly a strategic resource. It affects human societies in ways that most of us really don't fully appreciate. And yet soil degradation is also probably one of the biggest 21st century environmental crises that is wildly underappreciated. What do we tend to think of as strategic resources? Well, oil, obviously, in a geopolitical way. We tend to think of perhaps the atmosphere as a strategic resource if we're worried about climate change, as we should be. And we tend to think about water as a strategic resource in terms of a resource that is not quite in as abundant a supply as its fresh state as we might like as a globally dominant species now. Soil is the resource that's just as fundamental as those others, but that we tend to take essentially for granted. And it's my contention, and I'm not the first by any means to make this argument, that soil degradation really is a major underappreciated crisis that has had and is going to have global effects that will affect human societies. Now, if we look at the extent of soil degradation globally today, there's an awful lot of the world, and particularly areas where there's a lot of people. that the soil is basically classified as either very degraded or degraded. That in some way has impacted the ability of that soil to actually grow the food that we all depend on to maintain society. Soil degradation is truly a global phenomenon at this point. How significant is that? Well, David Pimentel at Cornell in his while ago basically had a paper in Bioscience that argued that since the Second World War, farmers have abandoned about 430 million hectares of land to crop production on a global basis. That's equal to about one-third of all the present cropland in the world. It's an area about equal to the size of China and India combined. In other words, kind of while nobody was really watching and thinking at a global scale, we've managed to reduce the area that we are growing food on by about a third at the same time that our population has risen dramatically. And if you think about the problem of feeding the world later this century, whether you want to think about 2050 or 2100, it would sure be handy if we had that one-third of the world's cropland in a state that had its full allotment of native soil fertility. How fast are the world's topsoils eroding? Well, if you put the context in the global framework, their estimates of global soil loss in excess of soil production was on the order of 23 billion tons per year of topsoil that's moved off cropland to be moved to somewhere else. Not all of it reaches the sea. In fact, very little of it does. It's a whole other problem. But that equates to something less than a 1% topsoil inventory loss per year, about 0.7% according to Pimentel et al. Even if they're off by a factor of 2. That kind of a rate may seem really slow, but to a geologist it's really fast. Because basically if you run these numbers out, that means that quite literally within 150 years we're going to exhaust the world's topsoil off of our cropland. Now, I don't actually think that's going to happen because there's lots of other cultural, social, and economic interplays that will come in to prevent our sort of running out of dirt, if you will, as one reviewer of my book basically accused me of sounding the warning alarm on. But it's like we're not going to ever run out of oil either. What's going to happen is as it becomes scarcer, it's going to become more valuable. And if you think about the sort of rate of topsoil loss globally, at the time when the human population continues to increase, it makes no sense to be continually degrading our ability to grow food into the future. Because eventually, those curves will intersect, and Malthus will have been proven to have had a point after all. Now, what's the key kind of message that I want to get across in the book? Well, it's not that soils are eroding globally. That, I think, is known. But I wanted to essentially ask the question of what's the role of soil erosion in setting the longevity of human societies? I'm a bit of a history buff. I wanted to look back at the history of past societies. And when you do, there's really no mystery that things like climate change, natural disasters, and politics, war, and social evolution actually influenced ancient societies. I mean, if you look at climate change, you need to look no further than the Viking colony in Greenland that got froze out during the Little Ice Age when there was a cold snap and they couldn't maintain their society there when their economic ties to Scandinavia were broken, and they blinked out as an incipient society. Similarly, there were dynasties in Egypt that were done in by extended periods of drought that reduced the flow in the Nile to the point that they agriculturally collapsed. So there's no doubt that climate changes can actually do in societies. In terms of natural disasters, I've got a picture of Mount St. Helens up there because I'm from Washington State. It was the natural disaster in my own backyard. But it's to remind me to talk about the Greek island of Santorini. It was a Bronze Age civilization that basically built a beautiful city on an active volcano in the middle of the Mediterranean, sited about where that explosion would be happening if it was analogous to Mount St. Helens, because what happened to Santorini? Well, they had wonderful geothermally plumbed hot water in the Bronze Age. So they had this wonderful flowering of a very technologically, for their age, advanced society with great luxury and wealth because they controlled shipping in the Mediterranean, but they had horrible geological foresight. They basically built on an active volcano, and when that volcano erupted, their society ended. And I use them as an example of how a natural disaster can end a human society, in part because it's a great example, but also to make the point that vulnerability to natural disasters at a societal level is scale dependent. If you have a singular island state sitting on an active volcano, when that volcano goes, you're out of business. On the other hand, if you have, say, a major city that's impacted by a major hurricane, it is possible, at least in principle, to bring aid from other areas to bear on that area. In other words, if you have a large nation or a global society, there's an intrinsic resilience to sort of natural disasters that happen regionally, should we choose to practice that socially. Which brings us to the third impact on societies that we would find in all sort of history textbooks, and that's politics, war, and social evolution. People are sort of notoriously bad about, you know, sharing land and toys with our neighbors over long periods of time. And I'm not trying to argue that these influences have not shaped the course and fate of human civilizations. Obviously, they have. But what I wanted to ask in this book is, what about the role of soil? What about the way that people treated the land? Because after all, the fundamental condition for maintaining an agricultural civilization, as darn near all civilizations have been, is sustaining the soil itself as a physical body and its fertility. And I write in the book about sort of both as parallel concepts. I'll talk a little more tonight about just preserving the soil as a physical body, get into fertility a little in the end. But I wanted to essentially explore that issue. And when you do, if you look back at environmental history textbook, you'll run into the argument that soil erosion resulting from deforestation was influenced the demise of ancient civilizations around the world. Almost always you find that the cause is listed as simply as deforestation, the idea that you cut the trees down and the soil erodes away. Now, I've lived most of my life on the sort of mountainous terrain on the western edge of North America, and I cut my geomorphological teeth studying soil erosion from timber management practices in the Oregon Coast Range. Steep 45-degree slopes, the idea that when you cut the trees down, you lose the root strength, the soil can slide off the hill. You get a major increase in landsliding after you clear-cut steep slopes, no matter what certain industries may sort of advertise in the public media in Washington State. But you also, if you run the numbers, you can't possibly explain the wholesale loss of the soil from simply deforestation. You get small areas of greatly accelerated erosion, but the trees grow back within a decade, enough to start retarding erosion. So if you go in and clear cut a whole area of 45-degree slopes, you get a window of a decade or two where you're very vulnerable to a certain amount of erosion on a small part of the landscape. Now, if you're worried about, say, endangered salmon, which my first book was about, that's a big issue, because what does sediment do? It goes downhill. Where do the fish live? In the streams downhill. But if you're thinking about the problem of essentially the wholesale loss of soil off of broad regions of topography, you run the numbers and you really can't blame deforestation. It just doesn't add up. That brought me to sort of starting to ask the question, as I looked into the history of ancient societies, as could agriculture have actually been the real culprit? Could it have been the plow that followed the axe that was responsible for the wholesale loss of soil across regions of the ancient world that impacted societies? Now, if the answer to the following question was no, then I probably wouldn't have written my book. So you already am telegraphing the answer. But the question I wanted to investigate was, could agricultural soil erosion and degradation limit the lifespan of civilizations? And what I want to offer you is a bit of observations on the way that a geologist like myself would approach that problem, a bit of the evidence from the archaeological world that I was able to pull together to try and start addressing that, and then also share some of the data that I was able to pull together from more modern studies that essentially back up the contention, and then try and talk a bit about ways that we might actually try and not repeat the same experiment that ancient societies have already run, should we actually choose to learn the lesson of those societies. So let me first invite you to think about soil the way a geomorphologist does. Basically, you can think of it as the thin skin of the earth, the interface between biology and geology, if you want to. What a lot of geomorphologists would sort of frame it around is that you can think of it as a system that's produced, stored, and lost. We like to think in those terms. And if you think about soil as produced from the weathering of rocks, rocks get broken down into smaller bits, they get chemically transformed into different kinds of minerals, it gets mixed with biological matter, the roots of trees, fallen leaves, organic matter. You put those two things together and you have soil. You can think of soil on a hillside as the standing stock of soil that reflects the balance between that rate of soil production and also the rate of erosion. And if you have any kind of a sloping surface, you know, fraction of a degree on up to about 45 degrees, and you don't get much soil over 45 degrees because it just won't stay there, and this is why most cliffs tend to be made out of bedrock. But essentially, if you think of soil as that kind of a system, where it's produced from weathering, it's lost from erosion, and what you find on a hillside reflects that balance, then you're starting to think of the soil in a way that a geomorphologist does. And you can think about it essentially the way you think about your bank account. You've got income. That's equal the analogy to weathering. You've got your expenses. That's your erosion. You have savings, I hope, some savings in the bank. You can think of soil on a hillside as our collective natural savings account. And having run the the experiment of spending money a lot faster than I make it several times now in my life, I can testify that if you do that for long enough, you run out of money. Soil is no different. It's really no different. It's got that same input minus output equals change in storage. If you're eroding soil faster than you're building it, you are burning up your agricultural savings account. And the question is, how long can it go on for? Well, if we think of soil as a system, the other thing we need to think about is how diverse is it? They're incredibly diverse. There's several hundred thousand specific different kinds of soils on this planet. There's probably, you know, multiple types on most farms in most parts of the world. Point being is that they're incredibly diverse. There's not sort of one kind of soil in the world. They're very locally adapted. Now, with those two things in mind, let's ask the question of, well, what might be the mechanism that would connect agricultural practices to the wholesale loss of soil across regions? And I think the answer is fairly simple, the plow. If you look at the invention of the plow as connected to agricultural soil loss around the world, it's fairly well connected. Why? Well, what does a plow do? It basically turns the earth and leaves it bare for some portion of the period of a year until the next crop comes out. How many places in the world have you ever been to that was a native grassland or a native forest where you saw bare soil at the surface of the earth? There's not many places. It's the arid regions of the world where you tend to find soils that don't have a soil cover. There's been a positive feedback ever since land plants evolved where the growth of plants shielded soils from erosion that promoted the development of soils that essentially fed plants. And plowed fields erode far faster than soils are made. I'll show you data that verifies that in a little bit. But essentially, what did the invention of the plow do? It altered that balance between the production and loss of soil on the lands that we tend to grow food on. And this has triggered a problem that has plagued societies, both ancient and continues to plague modern society. And it's a fairly simple and ancient connection. There's a bit of an irony there because essentially the invention of the plow and then the decision to actually hook it up to animals to essentially increase the ability of individual farmers to feed more people led to the development of Western civilization. We would not be sitting here in a room as grand as this with technology like this if we hadn't embarked on that technology thousands of years ago. But it came at a price that not many of us tend to recognize. And that's the degradation of land that has done in many of the regions of the world where farming originated. I want to use classical Greece as a major example of this. I go through many examples in the book, all that I could find. I tried to be pretty encyclopedic because that's what I'm trained to be. But I want to just give you a couple examples from history because I don't want to talk till midnight. And the basic story is often the same in society after society. In classical Greece, for example, cycles of erosion and soil formation began in the Bronze Age, several thousand years before the time of Christ, right after the introduction of plow-based agriculture. The plow arrived from the Middle East. It came to the Greek landscape. At that time, it was open oak woodland where you had about a 1 to 3 foot thick soil on the hillsides. And when the plow arrived, cultivation essentially spread from the valley bottoms up onto the hillsides. Why from the valley bottoms? Well, that's where you had relatively flat, relatively easily worked land that was watered by rivers. And as the population grew, farming essentially spread up onto the hillsides, and the clock started ticking as plowing started to leave the soils vulnerable to erosion on the hillsides where annual flooding was not replenishing the soil like it does on a floodplain. And so as grain spread up onto the hillsides of ancient Greece, over time, the soils were stripped off and they ended up down concentrated in the valley bottoms. And Van Alst and Reynolds had done the geology and the archaeology to put this story together for parts of southern Greece. They would find things like agricultural implements for growing wheat that were up on the hillsides where there wasn't any soil left, where you couldn't possibly grow wheat today. And they put the basic story together. Now, most of the soil actually ended up down in the valley bottoms. It didn't make it out in the Mediterranean. And so the total volume of soil in the landscape didn't change all that much. But the problem, of course, is that the process of farming doesn't depend on the volume of soil in the landscape. It depends on the surface area. If you take it from a large area in a thin layer and pile it up into a thick pile at the valley bottoms, you've reduced the area that you can actually use to support the population. How big a deal was this in classical Greece? Well, again, Van Andels and Runnels published a figure that actually got me started on writing this book. When I saw this figure in their work, where they looked at the population density of the southern Argolid, a particular region in southern Greece, since 6,000 BC over there on the left over to about now on the right. And you basically notice a couple aspects of these curves. There's sort of two fundamental aspects to this curve that I think are interesting. One of them is really trivial, and the other is, I think, incredibly important. So let's start with the trivial one. You get this population. It runs up in the Bronze Age when agriculture was introduced. It crashes for a few thousand years. It runs up in the Classical Age. It crashes again, and then it runs up in the Modern Age. The trivial part of this curve is the amplitude of those cycles. You could support more people per hectare of land each time society came back. Why? Well, they had better technology. We've got better technology, agricultural technology today than they did in the Bronze Age. It's fairly simple. We can grow more food on the same amount of land. No real debate or argument there. But what sets the periodicity of these curves? Why a run up for a few thousand years, a crash for a few thousand years, and then repeating it over again? And what about off to the right? And is this a possible global analog? There's not many places in the world where there's been three successive agricultural societies occupying the same piece of land. And there's even fewer where the geoarchaeology's been done, which is why I like using southern Greece. So, of course, the question is this essentially a cautionary tale about what we could be doing globally in terms of soil exhaustion and erosion? And if so, what's going to happen off the far right end of the graph? Well, I'm not the first person to worry about that kind of a connection. It turns out that Plato did. He was writing in the time of classical Greece, right at the peak of that second hump. And he was looking at the problem of soil erosion from the Bronze Age soil erosion event. What was he looking at? He was seeing things like oak trees around farm fields that were sitting on pedestals of soil a meter or so above the surrounding plowed fields. And he sort of connected the dots and went, the soil used to be thicker here. There used to be more soil. And he was complaining about how the landscape was not able to support as many people and raise as large armies as it had in the olden days, the Bronze Age. And he was particularly worried about that because they were trying to keep the Persians out of Greece. The passage that he wrote is worth quoting in full in describing this, because he wrote that the rich, soft soil has all run away, leaving the land nothing but skin and bone. But in those days, the damage had not taken place. The hills had high crests, and the rocky plain of Phellus was covered with rich soil, and the mountains were covered by thick woods, of which there are some traces today. He was basically recognizing the erosive effects of the Bronze Age soil erosion event and complaining about its effect on the Greek population. In other words, he probably deserves credit to be as one of the first geomorphologists. He's not generally recognized as such. The reason he didn't get a lot of recognition for this insight, I think, is in part because he wrote it in the dialogue that he wrote about the history of Atlantis, which is not viewed as the most credible of classical sources. But I think he really sort of got the short end, the history's stick there. He made fundamental observations about the world, about the soils, and connected it, and was the first, I think, to basically make the argument that the land can take care of societies conditioned by the way that people take care of the land. It was almost a Leopoldian type of ethic, but from the 4th century BC.
You are listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. The speaker is David R. Montgomery, author of Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, and a MacArthur Genius Award recipient. Back to the lecture.
Well, let me skip over many societies in between and not talk about Rome, which had a similar story, or Northern Africa, or the Chinese, or Easter Island, or a whole bunch of places. And let me skip straight to colonial North America. Why? Well, in researching this book, I discovered that soil erosion played a much greater part in the history of the United States and its social and economic and political development than I ever imagined when I started researching the book. Essentially, what got the colonial states going? It was tobacco cultivation. Why tobacco cultivation? Well, because it was the one thing that you could grow in the early colonies and that you could ship back to Europe at a substantial enough profit to basically keep European goods and services coming back on the ships the other way, because tobacco would survive the trip. It could be sold at a great profit. The Spanish had the monopoly on Caribbean tobacco early on. The British Crown, when they figured out that they could grow tobacco in Virginia, basically realized it was an incredible tax source because their citizens were becoming addicted to tobacco, buying a lot of it, and they could essentially run their empire off of the tax income. And this kept the colonial states going for a long time until that little tax issue got sort of in the way and led to the creation of our country. The point, though, is that tobacco was an incredibly erosive crop to grow using colonial techniques. You could get about 3 to 5 years of production out of a piece of land before you needed to clear new land and go on further into the continent. This led to essentially the development of widespread plantation agriculture. There were two other things going on at the time. In North America, land was cheap, and labor was expensive. You had to buy your labor, you took your land. In Europe, it was exactly the opposite. Land was really expensive and labor was cheap. They were exporting people like my ancestors as fast as they could get rid of us and send us to the New World. And land was being amalgamated by the upper class into larger and larger holdings. This led to a lot of innovations like crop rotation and animal husbandry and essentially ways to try and restore the fertility of the land. In North America, that wasn't happening. That's why land was cheap. It was the cheapest input into the agricultural production process. Still, people like George Washington were very concerned about the effects of colonial erosion on the future of the United States. Washington's quote is worth reading in full for that effect. He was complaining of declining crop yields in the late 18th century as soils in the eastern seaboard were exhausted. He wrote that a few years more of increased sterility will drive the inhabitants of the Atlantic states westward for support, whereas if they were taught how to improve the old, instead of going in pursuit of new and productive soils, they would make these acres, which now scarcely yield them anything, turn out beneficial to themselves. Washington was arguing quite explicitly that the future of the United States lay in crossing the Appalachians and in westward expansion of the country, not because of a manifest destiny to civilize the continent. That was reverse engineered at the end of the 19th century. This was basically because he saw the effects of soil degradation on an agricultural society on the eastern seaboard driving American farmers across the Appalachians to get at the good virgin soils on this side of the mountains. He was fairly prescient in that regard. Well, how bad was the soil erosion along the eastern seaboard historically? It's the hill country, the Piedmont country, the upland areas that are analogous to, say, southern Greece, the areas where you have a thin soil, 1 to several foot thick soil naturally over rock. And you'll notice that this map shows you 4 to 10 inches of soil erosion since the onset of colonial agriculture. There's areas that have greater than 10 inches of erosion. Well, is that a big deal or a little deal? There was only 12 inches of thick, fertile, black topsoil in this region to begin with. And so if you basically, and this is fairly well constrained, if you basically accept the idea that a couple hundred years of colonial agriculture, mostly plow-based, moldboard plow-based agriculture, could result in enough erosion to basically strip off a third to darn near all the topsoil off of what was originally the agricultural breadbasket of our country, and we could do it in a couple centuries, it starts to put into perspective that the idea that the classical Greeks, with a 1,000-year run at it at a time, or a 2,000-year run at it, could actually plow off most of their natural endowment of topsoil over the centuries, happening at a pace that's fairly slow enough that you don't necessarily notice it year to year or perhaps even lifetime to lifetime, but that adds up nonetheless in the end. So this starts to basically give some perspective that maybe this hypothesis that I phrased at the beginning might not be all that crazy after all. Now, this is, I'm going to pick on my own home state of Washington here for a few minutes because it's kind of, you know, the more ugly the pictures get, the better you, the more it's good to pick on your home. This is the Palouse. It's eastern Washington. This is a winter wheat field from the 1970s, about 40 years after the establishment of the Soil Conservation Service. And you'll notice all those little channels in the field, rills, things you could plow right over and essentially erase on a yearly basis with a tractor. Those are the reasons that a geologist like me would look at this landscape and go, the soil is just bleeding off of it. How fast does it actually happen? Well, in the Palouse, there's a dramatic example that was photographed by Vern Kaiser back in 1961, where he basically took a photograph of, it's a winter wheat field. That fence up in the upper right-hand corner is a fence that the farmer built around his water cistern in 1911, back when the land was up at that level. It's labeled 1911, the original grassland surface before he broke it. The only thing that happened to this field since then was winter wheat. So over the course of 50 years, you essentially eroded off about a 5-foot section of soil. There's a little thin black line. That's about a 5-foot cliff. It formed over the course of nothing but sort of rain, that kind of rill erosion, rain erosion off of plowed fields for 50 years. So 5 feet in 50 years, that's about a foot a decade. That's about an inch a year of topsoil loss. About 50% of the original topsoil off the whole Palouse has been eroded off in the past century. In other words, we're repeating in eastern Washington virtually exactly what we did on the eastern seaboard of the United States. So, of course, that example from the Palouse is an extreme example. That's why I like to use it, right? It's extreme. You should be asking yourself, well, how typical is it? And that's exactly what I was asking myself. And so I did something that has kind of gone out of fashion a little bit, and I basically took several weeks in the summer when my graduate students were all off doing their own work, And I basically just went to the library and I vacuumed up all the data I could find on rates of topsoil loss, both short-term under different agricultural systems and also long-term geological rates of topsoil loss. I basically compiled all the data that I could find. And I also wanted to basically test with real numbers whether this hypothesis that you could erode enough soil off of the landscape agriculturally over a reasonable period of time, that it was relevant to looking at the lifespan of human civilizations. So basically, I found 1,400 studies. Why did I stop there? Well, I ran out of time. School started again. I had to start lecturing and doing things that, you know, I actually make my living doing. And so I did not include any data from sediment yield studies. You know, I didn't look at what's coming out of a river basin. I looked at point source losses because stuff can get stored on the way down through a river system. And I didn't look at any universal soil loss equation based studies. I didn't look at any modeling based studies. I wanted to just look at real data. And so what did I find? Basically, four different kinds of data are up there. Over there on the far left-hand side, there's erosion rates that are less than a 1/10,000th of a millimeter a year. Over there on the right, basically the far right, you see erosion rates that are up to more than 10 millimeters a year, decimeter a year kind of rates. Those are erosion rates that you get, say, at the bottom of the Tsangpo Gorge, the biggest, most erosive gorge in the high Himalaya. It's incredibly fast. To a geologist, you know, a centimeter a year is screamingly fast. So first thing, erosion rates are really variable all over the planet. There's not sort of one simple number. Second thing is if you take those three white data sets, the next three levels up, those show you the data I found for long-term geological erosion rates, and I've stratified by three different kinds of environments. There's cratons. What's a craton? It's not something that is in a salad. It is something that is in the middle, the flat middle part of a continent. So we're sitting on a craton here, the heart of Africa, the Amazon Basin. You know, it's basically places without a lot of relief, so low slopes. They erode fairly slowly, in great part because they're relatively flat. And by relatively, I work in the high Himalaya, so I have a whole different sort of sense of what's flat and what's steep. But cratons erode up to rates of like 1% of a millimeter a year, really slowly, in other words. Soil-mantled terrain, the next level up, places that erode up to over about a millimeter a year. What's that like? It's like the rolling hills of California. It's probably like the steepest terrain in Iowa. It's like it's like the Piedmont in the southeast. They erode places up to about a millimeter a year. And if you think about long-term soil production as being balanced with erosion, you can start to see that the places that we would actually farm at a global level, the cratons and soil-mantled terrain, places that are not the alpine and glaciated high mountains. If you look at that, the long-term soil erosion rates in any place we would consider farming globally are less than a millimeter a year. What are the USDA's soil loss tolerance values that are used to define sustainable agriculture? Well, they can be about half a meter to a millimeter a year. In other words, they're slammed to the far right-hand side of any place of the long-term erosion rates that we would normally consider farming. In other words, even if you follow those, it's not necessarily sustainable. The black data sets up at the top are the agricultural erosion data. Those are for conventional, and by conventional I mean plow-based agriculture, from anything from small farms in developing nations to fairly large farms in this country. And if you play the simple game of sort of which of the natural environment erosion rates do the agricultural data most resemble, you basically come to the conclusion fairly readily that conventional farms are eroding like steep alpine topography. In other words, we've managed to convert places like Iowa, places like Nebraska, places like Tennessee, into places that are eroding like the high Himalaya, and we've done it on a global basis. And this should be an incredibly sobering realization. It's not something we should be, it's quite an accomplishment, but it's not something we should necessarily be proud of. Now, that was the bad news slide. Now, when you add another axis and a couple other data sets, you can actually turn it into a good news slide, which is what I want to do here. What I've done, I've taken the same data sets, and this time I have erosion rate plotted on the vertical axis, and the two black lines on it show you the data I just showed you. That upper one is conventional plow-based agriculture. The lower black line is the global geological erosion data for all parts of the world. Now, what I've added are essentially erosion rates under native vegetation, which is essentially the triangles that plot on top of that lower black line, and rates of long-term soil production, where people have essentially determined how fast our soil is produced. And that's the other white line, the open circles. And you'll notice that those two lines plot right on top of the long-term geological erosion rate data, or at least pretty close. And that actually validates that idea that soil production over the long run is balanced by soil erosion over the long run. Why? Well, the curves are about the same. The other bit of data that I have on there is labeled conservation, and what that is conservation agriculture. So it's essentially agriculture. It's no-till agriculture. It's agriculture that is practiced essentially prioritizing soil conservation. You'll notice that it plots on a global basis right on top of the long-term geological erosion rate data. That's the good news, because basically it demonstrates that the problem that we have with agricultural soil erosion is not simply the problem that we farm. I mean, if that was the conclusion that I had come to, it would be, you know, what's the answer? Well, it's just like party till you burn the planet up, right? I mean, it's because there'd be no way to solve that. But it turns out that we actually can farm quite intensively in ways that actually do not result in long-term degradation of the soil. Now, there's all the problems with all the different kinds of soils in the world and different places on any individual farm and all that kind of stuff. But if you look at it at a global level, like a geologist would, you can make a credible case that basically we don't have to necessarily repeat the exercise that ancient societies have gone through. The bad news, of course, is that the methods of conservation-intensive farming that it would take to actually do that are what we call alternative agriculture. Let me show you one other bit of data before I sort of do a little back-of-the-envelope math, and that is what's happened, as a geologist, what's happened over geologic time to soil erosion. Well, a guy named Bruce Wilkinson at the University of Michigan a few years ago was audacious enough to actually ask that question and try and reconstruct it. He did a really neat study where he took all the sedimentary rocks in the world and figured out how fast would the mountains, wherever they were, have to have been eroding at what part of geologic time to explain those deposits. What he basically found is that over the last half a billion years, the last 500 million years, the average rate of soil erosion off of a continent was about an inch every 1,400 years or so. What he also, if you take the USDA's assertion that the average rate of soil production at present is about an inch every 500 years, which isn't all that far off from the mean of the average of the data that I compiled, you can basically make the case that over time, over the last half billion years, soils have been building in thickness on the surface of the Earth. The rate of soil production exceeded the rate of soil loss. And that's consistent with the idea that most surfaces over most of the Earth have soil on them. What's the average rate of soil erosion at present? If you look globally, it's on the order of about an inch every 60 years or so. In other words, in the last century or two, we've basically flipped this long-term pattern for which the planet was actually building soils to one in which we have been losing soils on a global basis. It's as fundamental a shift in the nature of the surface of the Earth as anything you might care to point out, which is obviously why I'm pointing it out.
You are listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOI Community Radio. The speaker, geologist David R. Montgomery, spoke on the ISU campus earlier this fall.
Now, if you take that net loss of soil from agricultural fields on the order of a millimeter a year or so, and you take that at face value, what does that mean for the hypothesis that I started with, the relevance to the longevity of human societies? Well, let's do the math. If you take the net loss of a millimeter a year or so, it implies that if you have a half meter to a 1 meter thick pile of soil, a 1 to 3 foot thick soil on a hillside, which is about the global average for a native soil, you could literally erode through it in 500 to 1,000 years or so. That's approximately the lifespan of most major civilizations outside of the key exceptions, which, of course, are the major river floodplains of the world, places like the Tigris and Euphrates, the Nile, the rivers of China, places where agriculture originally developed, in part subsidized by erosion of the uplands. A floodplain gets fertilized year after year with the deposition of material during floods, and you can make a very good case that the degradation of land in Ethiopia and Somalia essentially fed Egypt for thousands of years. And so the resilience of the societies that existed for thousands of years continuously was in great part because of their physical geography. They were on major river floodplains where they were receiving nutrient supplements from the degraded uplands. Well, I'm obviously not the first person to point this out. Walter Loudermilk, a gentleman I never had the pleasure of meeting, wrote about this 50 years ago, or 60 years ago now, in 1953, when he wrote that here in a nutshell, so to speak, we have the underlying hazard of civilization. For by clearing and cultivating sloping lands, and most of our lands are more or less sloping, we expose soils to accelerated erosion by water or by wind, and in doing this, we enter upon a regime of self-destructive agriculture. He was on to all this. How did he sort of figure this out? Well, he looked at some of the same areas I was looking at in terms of Greece, Italy, Northern Africa, Israel, Mesopotamia, places where you don't really think of as agricultural powerhouses today, but that were in the classical world when they still had relatively good soil. Well, so this raises the question of, well, is it possible to reverse soil degradation? Can we reverse this historical pattern? And how would we do that? Well, if the problem arose from our agricultural practices, well, then the answer clearly lies in changing our agricultural practices. That should not be terribly controversial, as much as it might be. How would we do that? Well, we could reduce subsidies for conventional erosive farming practices. From a geological perspective, it makes absolutely no sense at a societal level to be rewarding farmers for practices that degrade the land in its ability to feed future generations. We could increase support for no-till practices on those lands where it's suitable, and I know it's not suitable for every sort of microclimate and every sort of soil type, but it does radically reduce erosion rates. We could increase subsidies or encouragement for crop rotations, cover crops. We could promote practices that increase soil organic matter both to sequester carbon and also improve soil fertility. In other words, there's things we could do to our agricultural incentives and disincentives and the market sideboards, if you will, that exist on any reputedly free market system that basically can shape people's behavior. But the thing that gives me the most hope is not the sort of political will to ever actually do any of those things. It's the fact that it's possible to physically rebuild soils surprisingly fast. If you take the rates at which nature rebuilds soils and you say, well, we could build an inch of soil in 500 years, who wants to wait that long? You know, the answer is nobody. But it turns out that there are really good examples of places where with human labor, application of labor, resources, and intelligence, we can actually rebuild soils far faster than nature can. Is something that I actually learned in my wife's garden, where basically we bought a house in North Seattle where the soil had been stripped off back to glacial till when we got it. There wasn't a single worm in our lawn. It was basically sterile. She's a gardener. She got really upset by that. She wanted to restore our soil. It only took her about 8 years to rebuild a couple inches of a fairly fertile A horizon and start just sort of a whole explosion of life in our yard that has led to an incredibly bountiful garden at a place that was just barren about a decade ago. How'd she do it? Well, with the application of labor and organic matter. It's the two things that we have a surplus of, at least in cities, and it's worth thinking about how we might actually conceivably run the same experiment that a couple ancient societies that proved to be the exceptions to my general model of soil degradation and societal limitation. The two really good examples of that are places that built very fertile carbon-rich soils by anthropogenic activity, where you found the best soil where there was the most people, not the most degradation, but the best soils where there was the most people for the longest time. And the Dutch were a great example of that. Something like, what, a third to 40% of Holland was basically reclaimed from the sea. They built the incredibly rich Plaggen soils. They're some of the best agricultural soils in Europe. How? By returning urban organic matter back to the land in a very focused program over the course of decades to build new farmland. The terra preta soils of the Amazon are the other sort of a great example. There's others in terms of the Inca and some islands in the South Pacific that built soils also. But what are the terra preta soils? Well, if you think about what are the natural soils in a place like the Amazon rainforest, they're incredibly nutrient depleted. It's hot, it's wet, it's flat. So all that hot rainwater, it percolates through the soil, strips out the nutrients. Almost all the nutrients that are in play in that ecosystem are in the canopy and the trees, cycling around. So when you clear the forest, you export all the nutrients. You can get 4 or 5 years of good agriculture, of subsistence agriculture out of it before you're down to basically trying to farm bedrock, weathered bedrock that is nutrient depleted. Doesn't last, in other words. But the best soils in the Amazon are these thick, black, fertile soils called the terra preta soils that are in the areas of very high native inhabitant density. Why? Because they basically returned all their cooking fires and their ash and their urban wastes back to their fields and over thousands of years built these soils that are almost like potting soil. It's incredibly rich and fertile. In fact, they mine it, dig it up, and ship it to the cities in Brazil and sell it as potting soil. But they basically showed that you can actually improve soils through intensive occupation and intensive human density. In other words, people might be the solution, not the problem, if we actually change the way we think and act towards soils. Why would we bother trying to restore soils globally? Well, in my view, it's to address some of the big challenges of the 21st century. I'm not going to go into the details of all four of these. I've got a different talk that can do that. But essentially, putting carbon back in the ground actually can take a dent out of our atmospheric CO2 emissions. It's not going to solve the CO2 problem by any stretch of the imagination, but it can actually help a lot, surprising amount. Restoring soil can actually help feed a post-oil world. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Restoring soils in cities can actually have a big impact on public health, mental health, and physical health, and city livability. And it can also could also help globally with the global biodiversity crisis and the problem of environmental degradation. In other words, I don't know of any other single act you could suggest other than restoring soils that would help solve four of the biggest problems we face as a species. Soil restoration would contribute towards all of them. It won't solve any of them, but it will help solve all of them. The problem of feeding a growing population is one I probably don't even need to show a slide to anyone anymore about. We know that we're going to have another 3 or 4 billion people in the next 50 or 100 years. Nobody knows what that curve will actually do. The big question is what happens the 100 years to the right of that, obviously. But if you think about how we can feed the world in the future, you quickly run into the problem that we're not going to run out of oil, but we are going to run out of cheap oil. If you basically look at the industry's own data in terms of oil production, we're sort of at the peak oil production now. Whether we were a few years ago or are a few years from now, to a geologist, doesn't really matter. We're kind of there. What's going to happen to the price of oil as we run off the right-hand side of that curve? Does anybody think the price of oil will go down in real dollars in the next century? Only one person has ever raised their hand. And he was a bit of a contrarian, so what can I say? So what's the strategy we've actually used for the last 50 years to maintain agricultural production and feed the first part of the run-up of that global population curve? It's to intensify our use of fossil fuels and of industrial-produced fertilizers to actually keep crop yields up. It's worth asking the question on a societal level of whether we're going to be able to maintain that strategy over the long run as oil supplies dwindle and prices rise dramatically later this century. What's that going to do to fertilizer prices? What has it done to fertilizer prices periodically when there's oil shortages? We know there's a coming global oil shortage, but it's decades over the horizon, and we're not going to literally run out, but it ain't getting any cheaper. And that motivates the question of how are we going to feed a post-oil world without cheap fertilizer-intensive agriculture? If somebody can invent a super clean, abundant, cheap source of energy, well, then the fertilizer problem is going to sort of not be quite as central as it will be if somebody doesn't. But it's worth wrestling with the question. I put an editorial out in Nature a few years ago basically arguing we need to invest globally in what I'd like to call a greener revolution. And look into the potential for increasing crop yields from no-till and organic agriculture, which can compete with conventional agriculture, and particularly some of the lessons from the droughts of the last few years in terms of the resilience of crop yields under no-till from the farmers I've been talking with the last couple of years have been very educational for me. But the other thing is that that one-third of global cropland that's been degraded since the Second World War, what if we actually restored the soil on it, got it back in production? What if we were able to actually restore its fertility? No matter how one looks at it, though, I think, if you look at how we're going to feed ourselves in 100 years, or even 200 years, if you really want to think like a geologist, it's going to be important to actually restore native soil fertility. Why? Well, because over the long run, it's more efficient, and we'll be able to feed more people that way, especially if the cost of energy keeps going up. And I like to advertise when I argue that, I'm not really trying to make an argument about pitting low-tech organic agriculture versus GMO and agrotech as opposite ends and arguing we have to choose one or the other. What I'm basically arguing, really, is that we have to learn how to apply an understanding of soil ecology to the applied problem of increasing and sustaining, and that's the part we tend to forget about, and sustaining crop yields over the long run in a post-oil world. Why? Well, because we're not going to be able to rely on oil a century from now. So basically, I think it's time for a new view of the soil. If we've gotten ourselves into the same problem over and over again in societies, we're not going to solve that problem by thinking about things the same old way. That's my favorite Einstein quote that basically makes that. He was a pretty smart guy. So let's look for a couple minutes at how we viewed soil as a species over our history. For probably the most of our history, we viewed soil as a mystery. We haven't understood it. And in fact, I would argue that there's still many aspects of soil microbiology that are almost as mysterious to us now as the basic problem of fertility was millennia ago. And this is the Greek goddess of cereal, Ceres, just in case you're wondering who you're looking at there. But so most of our, for most of our experience as a species, soils were a mystery, something that was personified, deified, something to be revered. Still today, and for, again, most of our existence as an agricultural species, the soil was a means to a living. The land was meant to, was something to be worked. Come the Renaissance, soil became to be viewed as a decipherable mystery. It was something that could be studied. It could be understood. Leonardo wrote that we know more about the movement of the celestial bodies than about the soil underfoot. Sadly, that's as true today as it was 500 years ago. In the 19th century, we started to view soil as a chemical reservoir, the whole idea that you could just add fertilizers as needed to make up for the, what was limiting crop production became really the dominant view of that fed the agrochemical model that is still essentially practiced globally today. And soils were essentially viewed as something to hold the plants up as we fertilized them. Come the 21st century, soil increasingly came to be viewed as an industrial commodity. It was sort of the cheapest input to the agricultural production process in the industrialization of agriculture. And what do you do with the cheapest input to any commodity production process? You don't worry about wasting it. It's the cheapest input. And that, I would argue to you, is essentially what has happened to soils over the 20th century. As we industrialized farming, as we needed to feed the world. But what do we see soils as today? I would argue that over the last 20, maybe 30 years, and at an accelerating pace, we're starting to understand the linkages, the fundamental linkages between soil microbiota and plants in ways that we never would have been imagined in Liebig's day when chemistry was viewed as the driving force in soils. Seeing soils as an ecosystem, as a system to be understood and worked with rather than worked against, is, I think, something that could revolutionize agriculture and needs to revolutionize agriculture over the next century. In other words, is soil ecology really the future of agriculture? I would argue to you that I think it's the key to feeding a post-oil world, because we're going to need to learn how to harness the insights of soil ecology to restructure agricultural technology and feed the world based on soil building, ecological processes, and nutrient cycling. We're going to have to learn how to spin the nutrient cycling wheel faster rather than essentially trying to make additions to it. And finally, I just want to advertise that healthy soil, we could probably view it as is not really a silver bullet to the world's environmental problems. By no means is it that, but it could be a secret weapon. Why is it a secret weapon? Well, we're not thinking about it as essentially a weapon for the essentially trying to help address climate change, how to feed a post-oil world, and essentially improve public health. And there's sound studies that look at the effects of soil quality and physical, mental, and social health, both in cities and in rural environments. In other words, why would we want to restore soils? Well, for our own well-being. But first and foremost, really, soil restoration means we can no longer treat soil like dirt. And that's the real defense for the title of the book. And I'll leave the last word really to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who wrote right after the Dust Bowl, which you'll notice I actually got away tonight with talking about soil erosion in the United States without even mentioning the Dust Bowl till the end. When he wrote that a nation that destroys its soils destroys itself. That is as true today at a global level and scale as it was at a national level when Roosevelt wrote this. And I think we need to kind of think of soil security not just on a national level, the way that in the aftermath of the Dust Bowl we started to maybe think and talk about it. We need to think about it on a planetary level, at a species level, because we really do fundamentally depend on that as our for the source of our food, and we are quite literally running out of it. Well, I also will shamelessly plug Dirt, the book, my first book, King of Fish, A History of Salmon, and my new book, The Rocks Don't Lie, A History of Science and Religion, viewed through how geologists looked at the problem of Noah's flood. They make wonderful Christmas presents.
You have been listening to Heart of Iowa on KHOY Community Radio. This lecture, entitled Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, was delivered on September 23rd by David R. Montgomery, author of a book by the same title. A link to the author's website is given on our website, khoyfm.org, under the Heart of Iowa tab. I'm Greta Anderson, and I edited the lecture to fit our 55-minute format. Richard Morrison engineered the show. Our theme music is The Fisherman by Leo Kottke. KHOI is a community radio station. If you have comments on the show or know of a lecture that you would like us to record or broadcast, please contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Your participation as listener is what makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.